Hello and welcome to the Anxious Conservatives podcast. My name is Liam here and I am a freelance opinion haver, and I'm joined by my fellow Anxious Conservative, Monique Poirier of the Auckland Ratepayers Alliance, and a guest blogger for Kiwi Blog, which is New Zealand's premier political blog. We're joined tonight by Juliet Moses, lawyer and author, who just happens also to be a spokeswoman for the New Zealand Jewish Council, but who is here in her own capacity. Hello, Monique. Hello, Juliet.
Hi.
Juliet, we wanted to talk about the recent decision of the New Zealand Super Fund to divest itself of all investment and entanglement with Israeli banks. But before we get to that, I just wanted to hit something on my mind, which is maybe you've got some light to shed on it. But why is it that after everything that's happened, everything that we know about history, no matter how much it's been drummed into us at school, why do we still have this irrational hatred that we call anti-Semitism with us?
Oh, God, how long have you got? Look, it's called the oldest hatred. It's been labelled that. It's very timely to call it this, but it's also called a virus that mutates. So it changes over time. Obviously, a long time ago when religion prevailed in society, it was driven by a religious, belief that the Jews had killed Jesus. Mm-hmm. During the Nazi era, it had more of a racial connotation to it. So Jews were hated as a race and, of course, considered by the Nazis to pollute the Aryan race. And now it's morphed again, or actually takes various forms, but in its most prevalent form now, it comes in the guise of hating the Jewish nation state, Israel. Why it's always been there, I can't tell you. It's if anyone knew, they could probably solve the problem.
Yeah. Is it a feature of the fact that the Jewish people have just over thousands of years proved so indestructible that, mm-hmm. I mean, despite all best efforts, frankly, and, some pretty horrendous ones, that just by continuing to exist in defiance of all those efforts to eradicate them from the face of the earth, that people of a certain mindset, they just stick out and they're just an easy target. Could it be something along those lines?
It could be. That's an interesting point, because most anti-Semitism, when you boil it down, it's a conspiracy theory. So it's this idea that Jews, and it's actually different to other forms of racism. So other forms of racism punch down, right? So they consider whatever the target race is as being inferior. It's kind of like a punching up with anti-Semitism. So there's this idea that Jews are kind of this shadowy, all-powerful cabal of people who exert control over all world events, government, wars, economy, media, whatever, and for their sort of nefarious end. So I suppose if you think of it that way, and as you've said, that the Jews have been around for 4,000 years and survived against all odds, then it could kind of play into that idea.
Monique, have you ever had any experience of anti-Semitism in your life? I mean, not you're not a Jewish person, but what I mean is, have you ever come across it?
I mean, from my lefty friends, I guess, yes. Just general rhetoric that you hear.
Yeah, the casual anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
So would that be, just to jump in. Okay. I mean, I've actually never experienced this myself, but I know a lot of people have, where people use the word Jew to mean, stingy, conniving, whatever. Has that ever come up for you?
Not so much that, but you think, like, for example, was it last year or the year before when Ilhan Omar made that comment about it's all about the Benjamins?
Yes.
And some of the comments that came out from that conversation, I sat there thinking, I mean, I genuinely think they sit there thinking, this isn't anti-Semitism, but it's like, it is. It is. What you're saying is anti-Semitism.
Well, that's an interesting sort of interesting point, because you know, it's sort of one of the rules of polite society, one of the sort of accepted ways that we deal with these issues, that if you're it's the members of that minority group, they get to specify what it considers to be prejudice and what's a manifestation of prejudice against it. And yet for some reason, it's like the Jewish people are the only people who aren't allowed to do that. It's like, is that like an observed thing? Like, is that something that's you've come across, Juliet?
Oh, absolutely. Not only that, it's one step further. It's not that Jews aren't allowed to decide for themselves what's anti-Semitism and what's not, but that when they make accusations of anti-Semitism that other people don't agree constitutes anti-Semitism, there's this accusation that Jewish people are deliberately sort of participating in this kind of conspiracy to suppress criticism of them, or in particular criticism of Israel, or, you know, that it's, again, it's sort of an orchestrated plot, which again plays into this very idea, this conspiracist idea that Jews are all kind of conniving to control the world. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, in New Zealand, the Daily Blog is an absolute shocker for this. They perpetrate that idea the whole time, that Jews are deliberately, in bad faith, making accusations of anti-Semitism.
That's why I can't go along with the idea of some of our fellow conservatives, Monique, when they say, oh, the Daily Blog's finally starting to talk sense, or the, you know, Daily Blog's, you know, you know, because they've got this sort of anti-woke bent to them, you know, that they're somehow not toxic, but you know, like, it's that example, and there's so many examples from that outlet of bad faith application of tropes, you know, just that, you know, I don't think it's reasonable to give them the benefit of the doubt, really. But on that, though, I mean, there are, I mean, I do have a lot of, you know, lib friends who just, they'll go along with the tropes, or they'll make reference to them, or they'll join in sort of, you know, one double standard, applying double standards to things like Israel issues and things, just because they're brain dead libs, you know, like, you know, like they, you know, like, you know, like they would be horrified if you, and that's why they're partly why it's so defensive to be told that they're going along with this. But, and apart from that sort of that brain dead anti-Semitism, there is, I just was so shocked one day when I was about 18 years old, and it was my first job between high school and going to uni, and I was working in a commercial laundry, and I got sort of struck up talking to this woman, and we got on really well. And then one day she said to me, look, I'm going to give you a book, but I don't want you to anyone else to read it, because I know you're really into politics, and I feel that I can trust you, and I've got this really interesting book you can read. And she bought it the next day, and it was called The Real Rulers of the World. You know, have you heard of that book in particular? But it was on the cover. It had, you know, it was a picture of the world, and it had like a snake wound around it. And I just was so shocked, because, you know, I read it, and it was, you know, it started off with, you know, the idea of, you know, of Jewish people killing Christ, and it had this chapter about how Jesus wasn't Jewish, you know, like, which we've heard, from New Zealand politicians. And so it just shocked me as a kid, as a 17-year-old, because, you know, it wasn't just this, you know, modern new anti-Semitism. It was actually this sincerely held classical anti-Semitism, you know?
Yeah.
It's just bizarre to think that it still exists, but there we are.
It's not going away, sadly.
No, but toxic worldview, is that something that still exists at large, do you think, or is that really quite much more isolated? Is most anti-Semitism in this country respectable anti-Semitism? Put it that way.
More of it is, yes. It's the more insidious form. I think, certainly as we know, white supremacy is growing around the world, including in New Zealand. And of course, anti-Semitism is part and parcel of white supremacy. But most, you know, right-thinking people, that's probably a bad turn of phrase, but you know, most decent people see that for what it is and can recognise the anti-Semitism there and the abhorrent ideology generally and will condemn it. So yes, I think in New Zealand it's more the kind of insidious stuff that comes in through the left or through demonization of Israel and certain attitudes towards Israel. And of course, when I say that, I have to be very careful to say, because otherwise I'll be accused of thinking otherwise, that criticism of Israeli policies that is equivalent to how we might, you know, criticize any other country is not anti-Semitism. It's not. We're talking about something very different to that.
Well, actually, that was the next thing I had in mind, right? I mean, like, obviously not all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, and you know,
of course not,
and you probably don't have to agree with everything that the state of Israel does, and of course not every Israeli citizen, good and loyal and true, criticizes sort of believes in everything that their state does. That's why they have such fractious politics. But
there just seems to be such an obsession with it, and then total just complete blanking of any other country, you know, in the Middle East or whatever, that is also commit, you know, it's bizarre.
So when, Julie, when in your view, when does legitimate criticism of the policies of the Israeli government of the day, when does that spill over to anti-Semitism?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There's a test that Natan Sharansky came up with, who was a very famous, don't know if you've heard of him, but he was sort of the very famous Soviet Jew who kind of led the movement to free Jews from the Soviet Union. He came out with a test called the 3D test, and he said, so it's either when there's demonization of Israel, delegitimization, or double standards. So demonization is when you really sort of play into those classical tropes about Jews, but you apply them to the Jewish state before. So blood libels, for example. So an example I often give, it's a good one, is that, you know, Israel's got this amazing field unit. It's part of the IDF, but it goes to, whenever there's a natural disaster, it offers to go and help anywhere around the world. So, you know, the earthquake in Haiti, for example, you know, things like that. When it went to Haiti to help, there were accusations that the unit was there. And by the way, it's been very well recognised by, even by the UN, amazingly. It's doing amazing work. It got accused of the fact it was going there to Haiti to harvest organs, right? So that's a perfect example of a classic blood libel updated to apply to Israel, or sort of a branch of Israel.
So the classic blood libel, correct me if I'm wrong, but the classic blood libel is that idea from medieval Europe that that Jewish people would kill baptized children to use their blood in rituals and things like that. Is that
correct?
Is that right?
And actually, to make matzah, which we talked about before, which is what you saw in the supermarket at Passover time. Yes, that kind of thing. You know, equating Israel with Nazis is a common one.
Yep.
So, I mean, sure, criticize Israel. Yeah, maybe you don't like the way they treat Palestinians, absolutely. Equating them with Nazis is absolutely ludicrous. It's also extremely offensive, obviously,
Israel,
where there's a lot of Holocaust survivors.
Yeah, it just seems like the only reason you would possibly choose that comparison out of everything in the world is just a punch below the belt, right? I mean, that's the best way of looking at it, is that you're punching below the belt on purpose.
So that's correct. Of course, it also trivializes the Holocaust as well. So it's like, you know, it's totally a double whammy. So there's that.
Yep.
Then there's delegitimization. So that's refusing to acknowledge any Jewish connection to, you know, the land of Israel, that they've got a history in the land, that Jesus was Jewish, as you say, all that kind of stuff. And then the third one is double standards. So when you hold Israel essentially to a higher standard than you hold to, you know, any other country.
So
we see that a lot of the UN, obviously, in particular.
I mean, so we take that that sort of categorization, and then so if we look at what's just happened this week with the New Zealand Super Fund, and I've got to say, yeah, I was really shocked when I heard about this. But so I read on the news that the New Zealand Super Fund has decided or agreed to divest itself from all investment or entanglement with Israeli banks, right? So yeah, if you were to if you were to look at that, would you see that as fitting in with that, any of those categories, and why?
Yes, I would see it fitting in certainly with the double standards, and probably with the delegitimization as well. That one requires a bit more explanation. The double standards, because it invests, very generously in China. I think it's over 400 million invested in Chinese investments, including Chinese banks. We all know what China is doing at the moment to the Uyghurs. It's been labelled as genocide by the US and Canada and other countries, other states. It occupies Tibet. We know about what it's doing in Taiwan and Hong Kong, etc. Turkey, there's investments in Turkey, including Turkish banks. Turkey absolutely occupies Northern Cyprus. We can go on and on. So the fact that it's chosen at this point to single out Israeli investments or Israeli banks in contrast to any other banks, I mean, invest in Saudi Arabia, we could talk about that for ages, but so that appears to be a double standard.
Do you want to, Juliet, do you want to just do a quick rundown of what the BDS movement is?
Good idea. So BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanction, and it's a movement. Calling it a movement is almost being generous. It's kind of a loose kind of alliance of people and organizations, I suppose. That aim to encourage people, pressure people to boycott, divest, and sanction against Israel. It's got three aims that are listed on its main website, but essentially, and there will be argument about this, but if you understand those three aims, it will say disingenuously, people will say, oh, it's just about, ending the occupation of the West Bank. It's actually about dismantling Israel. It does not believe the Jews have a right to, a state. And that's very clear, as I say, both from, if you understand what its three aims actually mean, also from statements from its proponents and supporters. It's very clear. So it purports to be a human rights movement. It likes to say that it's, boycotts brought down the apartheid movement, the apartheid regime in South Africa. We can bring down apartheid in Israel. Well, firstly, there isn't apartheid in Israel, but secondly, boycotts to say that it brought down South Africa or the apartheid regime in South Africa is very simplistic.
Yeah.
Thirdly, there was no, as far as I'm aware, no aim to actually end South Africa, whereas there is an aim to end Israel. Mm. So that is BDS in a nutshell.
Israel is not a perfect society, because when what country is, right? I mean, there's plenty of, and New Zealand's always been pretty critical of the settlements and things like that and the West Bank. But what I think people, what might surprise people is, what's the status, what are the civil rights status of Arab people living in Israel? Are they second class citizens?
No, Arabs in Israel, and look, I'll be honest, there are some problems of racism in Israeli society like there are in every society, but Arabs, they vote, they're represented in parliament, they've got the third biggest party in parliament, they sit on the Supreme Court, which is the highest court of the land, They have all the same civil rights that Jews or anybody else has in Israel. And by any objective measure, they're actually doing better in terms of healthcare, education, living standards than Arabs in any surrounding country. They've actually got more rights and a better life than Arabs in surrounding countries.
Arab Israelis do not have to serve in the military. They're not subject to conscription, I understand. But I do believe...
That's right. Increasingly, they're choosing to do so.
Yeah, and I think there's even been... There are even Arab Israeli generals, I think, or quite, you know, people quite high up in the command staff. It doesn't really sound like apartheid South Africa, at least in Israel proper, right? So if there are issues, there are really issues about those occupied territories, not Israel itself, right? Correct. So, So it's it seems a bit rough to call it an apartheid state, that's all.
Yeah. I mean, and in the West Bank, I mean, in Gaza, Hamas rules Gaza full stop. There are no Jews there except the ones who have been kidnapped. I mean, there are no settlements, no Jews living in Gaza. The IDF isn't in there, etc. Slightly, in the West Bank, it's a very complicated situation, but it is certainly not apartheid. I mean, under the Oslo Accords, so it was agreed between the Palestinians and the Israelis, there are three different areas of administration in the West Bank. There's Area A, which is under complete Palestinian administration. There's Area B, which is shared, and there's Area C, which is effectively what we call the settlements. Yeah. So it's a real hodgepodge, but all the Palestinians living under Palestinian administration, you know, they're governed by the Palestinians in their day-to-day life.
And this is where that vaccination thing from a couple of weeks came in.
Exactly. So they've got they administer their own healthcare. They've got their own laws, their own courts. They had their own legislature till it was disbanded in 2007. They had elections last time in 2006, and then they decided not to have those anymore, although hopefully those will be happening again this year. You know, they govern their day-to-day life. I mean, I've been there. I was there a year and a half ago and I met their prime minister. I mean, you know, how was that apartheid? That is what you want if you want to be a self-governing, self-determining people. So you can't have it both ways.
Which is not to say, of course, as you've pointed out, which is not to say that there aren't problems in Israel, and that, you know, like every society, you know, there's always going to be the struggle against intolerance and tolerating differences, and, you know, and that will be something I think they will always be doing in every society as long as there are people.
That's right. And I mean, Israel is actually an extreme, you know, we think we're diverse in New Zealand, and we are. Israel is extremely diverse. And then you throw in the mix as well the complications of religion, and you've got the ultra-Orthodox there and the secular, and you throw that on top of it as well.
And Beta Israel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you've got, you know, you're surrounded by countries that actually still want to wipe you off the face of the earth. So that's a bit of a challenge too.
So both Monique and I are Roman Catholics, and that's a religion that unfortunately has not had the best history with regards to the Jewish people. And, you know, from medieval times right through to actually, I mean, the Holy See has not had the best relationship actually with the state of Israel, and part of that's out of paranoia about, I think, you know, safeguarding holy sites and everything like that. So it hasn't been a great history between the institutional Catholic Church and the Jewish people, so I don't expect there to be a lot of trust there. But one thing that's really, and it's really interesting to me, is in the New Zealand experience, Catholics, Irish Catholics and others, were in particular often accused of being under control of a foreign potentate or having a dual loyalty. And it was a huge thing in New Zealand, and, you know, there was an organization called the Protestant Political Association. It was all about how Catholics were taking over the post office, and there was that Royal Commission inquiry into whether Catholics were taking over the civil service. And, you know, it's so bizarre. Look, it was a Royal Commission of inquiry into it, which found there were no basis. What was that, sorry? This was in the, was it? This was between the 30s, really been the interwar period. So when Sir Joseph Savage was the Prime Minister of New Zealand, was the first Catholic Prime Minister. But when he was Postmaster General, the accusation was that he was using his, he was bringing the post office under the control of Rome. But that's all just a little bit beside the point, because it seems surreal to us now. But I mean, as a Jewish person living in New Zealand, do you ever find you get accused of having a dual loyalty in that same way, you know, which would just seem bizarre?
I mean, again, if we go back a bit to the Daily Blog and some of the supposedly, you know, groups that support Palestinian rights, but are actually more interested in just being anti-Israel and, you know, delving into a bit of anti-Semitism from time to time, that absolutely comes through. Again, it's this whole idea of the Jews all sort of banding together and, there's been stuff about, Israel being sort of the puppet master of, you know, the Jewish community here, and we're sort of the agents of Israel exerting our influence on government and media, and so all that stuff, it all ties in together. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, one interesting thing about the Jewish community in New Zealand is that it is quite small. And our friend of the podcast, Chris Pink, I think, pointed out to me a little while ago about how New Zealand turned down, the first Labour government turned down Jewish refugees because they wouldn't assimilate, or they would, you know, be detract from our cultural life, which absolutely shocked me. But it is a small community, and growing up in the provinces, I only ever knew a few Jewish people, and really, it wasn't until I moved to Wellington, as we were talking about before we started recording, when I moved to Wellington, that I was working in a supermarket with my now wife, and every year around this time of the year, we would start to have the specialty food would come in, because there was obviously a community in Wellington. I think there's a synagogue, at least one synagogue in Wellington.
Yes. Yeah. Two.
Oh, there's two. Oh, is there a reform and a conservative one or something like that?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
And so, I mean, how big is the Jewish community in New Zealand? And is it pretty tight knit? Do you have a lot of solidarity?
It's a good question. Firstly, in terms of numbers, the latest census would tell you there's something like 5,000, which is way too low.
Yeah.
Good
question, because I think you could identify also as an ethnic Jewish person. I think I actually did that. Good question. I don't know whether the 5,000 was just religiously or what, but this becomes again quite a complicated question of identity, because Jews do identify in different ways. Some people consider themselves to be atheist, but will identify as Jewish because they're ethnically Jewish.
Culturally.
So there's all that kind of stuff. But so let's say it's sort of 10 to 12,000, right? Jews. So are we tight knit? Yes, but like any community, there's internal politics, there's differences of opinion. On matters, but I would say that mainstream or the, you know, the vast majority of Jews in New Zealand, you know, are supportive of Israel, believe it's very important to them, central to their identity, don't of course support everything Israel does, but you know, its existence is very important to them.
What's the French Quebec, what's the French Canadian community like, Monique? Is it very tight knit?
Do you band together to support Quebec? Full Kiwi. No, full Kiwi here.
I am
a cultural Kiwi.
Yeah. All right.
I should actually make that point that we are also, I mean, you know, most Jews are very grateful to be living in New Zealand and very proud Kiwis.
And it's a bit like with anti-Chinese racism in New Zealand too, is that, you know, there are Jewish people and Chinese people who have been living in New Zealand since the 1860s. I mean, one of our one of our most influential prime ministers was Jewish, Julius Vogel. Man who built all the route. We can't get more New Zealand than that. More New Zealand than that, really. Look, we don't. It's been so interesting talking to you because I'm actually now running out of time. But I just wanted to circle back to the point of the podcast, which I've only asked one question about, which was the divestment by the New Zealand Super Fund. Yeah. Was that on your radar that that was going to happen? How did that come about out of the blue? Was it just because of pressure from the BDS movement, or was it something that you thought might just something just total bolt from the blue?
Well, kind of a bit of both. Like, it came as a shock. It's like, oh God, you know, and also I think they tried to slip it in under the radar. We only found out about it because the Palestine Solidarity Network, Aotearoa, was trumpeting about it. But they have been pressuring them for quite some time. And I came upon this OIA from 2018 that was just online, and I had a look at it. And, you know, there have been quite a few meetings and quite a bit of correspondence between that group and the New Zealand Super Fund.
And presumably there'll be a please explain, there'll be at least some, hopefully some questions asked of them about whether or not they're now going to review all their investments in the People's Republic of China. And other places where we criticised as well, but probably wouldn't hold my breath.
They have said they're now looking at the question of China in relation to the Uyghur people. But it seems a little odd to me that Israel, you know, the Jews building homes in their sort of ancestral homeland would be a higher priority than genocide. Mm. But that's just me.
Or in any event, you know, what? No difference with Chinese colonization of Tibet, really, which has been going on since the 50s as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. All right. Well, look, It was just a bizarre thing. I just found it so strange that that the New Zealand Super Fund would take what seems to be a very political action like that. You know, and certainly people have their people are right to have their opinions and those sorts of things. But there's probably all sorts of things that the New Zealand Super Fund is invested in that I don't like. But you know, as a role, you got to go with consensus on these things. You know, act independently.
I read the paper that sort of laid out the decision for the New Zealand Super Fund. I don't know who prepared it, but I mean, it was so shoddy and amateurish. There were so many mistakes in it. It was unbelievable. Things that should have been referred to that weren't. It was just, you know, I actually thought to myself, God, if this is the decision making that goes into all the New Zealand Super Fund decisions, then, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen to my pension in future.
Yeah. I mean, is your sense of things, I mean, there might be research on it, but are the people of New Zealand generally pretty supportive of Israel? I mean, not unconditionally so, that would be idiotic, but in general, do you find, is it the case that most New Zealanders are generally favourably disposed towards the country?
Oh, I think most would support Israel's right to exist. I mean, there is some evidence to suggest that. I think, however, quite a few have bought into this idea that, look, I think in New Zealand, we're very conscious of colonialism for obvious reasons. And I think a lot have bought into this idea that, you know, Jews were these kind of white colonialist usurpers who came along and dispossessed the Palestinians, who are the indigenous people, which is, of course, incorrect on numerous fronts. And, of course, kind of narrative resonates with us in New Zealand, so I think it does garner some sympathy.
That might bring us to a last point, I guess, which is that are Jewish people white? Because it seems that they're white for the purposes of colonialism, but they're not white for the purposes of being admitted into fancy golf clubs. You know, it's bizarre, isn't it?
Oh God, this is the long debate. I mean, traditionally, no, they haven't been considered to be white. In modern day parlance, they would. Some of us would be like me, I suppose, would be considered to be white passing. Yeah. So, but. And then, of course, you've got, and this is a whole nother story, but you've got identity politics, which I make no bones about the fact that I'm very critical of, that considers Jews to be almost like the kind of the peak of white privilege. So, you know, we're in this horrible position. We're sort of caught in the crossfire. Yeah. You know, white supremacists consider us not white. You know, the kind of identity politics, far left, critical race theory, people consider us to be the archetypal white privileged person. It's not a fun place to be in.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to end on that note. I suppose if there's anything to take from history, it's that you know, the Jewish people will always prevail. I mean, but it's as difficult as it will be, and it sounds like, you know, the New Zealand Super Fund has bought into the side of making it difficult, which is a shame. But we really appreciate you coming on the podcast and being able to send it out for our listeners. Any final thoughts, Monique?
Well, can I give...
Sorry, yes, by all means.
I want to end on a positive note, which is that, yes, I mean, there's always been anti-Semitism. We've talked about that. There's a lot of it around at the moment. But I just want to say that Jews are actually around the world in the best place they've ever been in, because we've got Israel and we know it's there as our refuge and our safe haven if we ever need it. And believe me, that actually comes into my head quite a bit, that thought. So so that's my positive note. Sorry to interrupt you, Connie.
Monique, if you want to think about your last thoughts, I'll just bounce off that quickly, because it does, but it also really does go to show, doesn't it, why Jewish people feel the need to have Israel, or why it's important to them, because you look what's happening in Turkestan and with the Uyghurs, and you see how hollow the promises of the world about never again are, because never again never is never again, is it? I mean, the only way to really ever be secure is to have a state.
That's right. Am I answering that, or is Monique?
No, just a comment. Monique, what do you think?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I, as a Catholic, went schooling, was very lucky to learn about Judaism through school and through religious education, and I think most Catholic schools do that now, so I think that's pretty cool.
Right, okay, so we're about to be cut off, so look, we're so grateful. Thank you so much for coming, Juliet.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Brilliant. That was me. This is the Anxious Conservatives podcast. That was Juliet Moses, Monique Poirier, and me, Liam, here saying good night.
Good night.
Bye.